Now, the question for Caitlin is, what role do you want to have in making it the world you want it to be? There's where this starts to get interesting. There's where it starts to get exciting, because the future is not set. It's a fool's errand to try and predict the future, but we can make it. And there's the challenge for the next generation.
You know, we can't go forward in a world like this that's filled with hatred. How are we supposed to, like, interact with the other people without being scared of what they might end up saying in conversation, or scared of them as people? We need to have more faith and love in others, and that's the way forward, right?
Welcome to Sustainability Decoded with Tim
and Caitlin.
On our podcast, we break down what's happening in climate, sustainability, and ESG.
And along the way, we help you get smarter about sustainability. So let's get into it.
It's back to school for today's episode. We had the opportunity to chat with Professor Andrew Hoffman from the University of Michigan. Andrew is the Holcomb Professor of Sustainable Enterprise, which means that he teaches in both the business school and the School for Environment and Sustainability. He offered fantastic advice to our resident vegan, climate activist extraordinaire, Caitlin.
I have to say, today's episode was fantastic for me. I got schooled on the difference between career and vocation, and that's okay because I learned so much. The best thing about working in sustainability is that people have a major sense of purpose, myself and Tim included, of course.
I'm going to go ahead and say today's episode is required listening for anyone trying to figure out what they want to do with their life, and Andrew's books are required reading.
I'm obviously biased, but I think our episodes just keep getting better. We'll let you be the judge. Here's our conversation with Andrew.
You can always make sense of your life when you look back on it, and to think it was planned is dishonest. So there's a lot of serendipity in how I ended up where I am at. And maybe I'm not giving myself enough credit to be in control of my life, but opportunities arose and I walked through them. I think there's a lesson here for students like Caitlin and others, is that I got an undergraduate degree in chemical engineering. I have no idea why. I like chemistry. I like math. I have no idea why, honestly. And I was doing it because I was a young punk who wanted to prove his mettle, and chemical engineering seemed like the hardest major, so I'm going to do that. And so I was beginning to get training in a job. And then Love Canal happened, and it shocked me, and it really impacted me in a way that I thought, oh, this is why I'm doing chemical engineering, to make sure this never happens again.
Love Canal was an environmental disaster in upstate New York in the late 1970s. It was a community built on a toxic waste dump site. As toxic chemicals leached out of the ground, the people living there were plagued by birth defects and inexplicable illnesses. The story became major news across the U.S. Andrew told us that because of this tragedy, he found a sense of purpose in environmentalism.
And to my mind, that's when my pursuit of an education shifted from skills to get a job to a calling, to a vocation, to a purpose. And that changed everything for me. I'd always cared about the environment, but now this gave me a way to do something about it.
Fantastic story. And it really relates to, I think, the conversation we're going to have. But let me ask Caitlin to jump in. I mean, you're the sort of, what do we call it now? Gen Zer?
Yeah.
What's your impression of Andy's story?
Well, no, I totally relate to the path not being a straight line or being even planned out. I mean, even myself, my path is very short right now, but it still kind of goes in waves and in loops and sometimes turns back on itself. And I think that's really normal. And the skills that you gain along that way, of course, you can implement into your future teachings and learnings. And yeah, no, I just fully agree.
I was reading about the multi-generational issues that are sort of cropping up now. People among Caitlin's generation, the majority of them poll that climate change is probably their number one threat. Mm-hmm. Other things like economic insecurity, of course, are there as well. But they see a very different future for themselves than maybe you and I did, Andy, when we were their age. Mm-hmm. How do we come to grips with the world that we've handed over to the next gen?
I see it in my students. They're very dark. Climate change, income inequality, political divisions. And importantly, I think that the Caitlin's generation, I hate to keep using you, Caitlin, as a moniker for an entire generation, but the next generation of business leaders grew into a world that's very unstable. I mean, what are the formative events in their lives? For some, 9/11, certainly the Great Recession, now COVID. So, Tim, you and I grew up in a world that was very stable and predictable. And students today are growing up in a world that can literally change on a dime. And in much the same way that my grandparents were influenced by the Depression, they were imprinted in ways that lasted their entire life. I think this generation is being imprinted by this kind of instability, this kind of rapid change, and what the world means tomorrow is much more difficult to predict than it was when you and I were coming up, Tim.
We've talked about this several times in the podcast before, but we think kind of as well that the younger generation, since we've grown up in these quite unstable times, we have more of a view of looking at our career or our vocation as a passion. And so it's great to be able to have that, you know, interdisciplinary view of things. You're a professor of sustainable enterprise. I was hoping maybe you could define what sustainable enterprise is and kind of why it's important, as well as, you know, how we bring the interdisciplinary look at that, right? So like how we bring business and environment together.
Well, going to what you said, I mean, one of the problems with the present structure in a university is that the problems in the world don't fall neatly on our disciplinary lines. You want to solve climate change. It's not simply just a business issue or a psychology issue or a scientific issue. It integrates all those. And so if you really want to find the real solutions, you need to be much more broadly focused in your education and how you approach it. And you said something, Caitlin, you interchanged it very quickly, but I think it's worth calling out. You use the word career and vocation interchangeably, and they're not.
They are in my mind, which is why it's
For you, they are. And I think that's good. And that's something that I'm really bringing in. I just got a grant from the Arthur Vining Davis Foundations to develop a program to take business students on retreats to discern their calling or vocation in management. And that takes them out of their head of this is just a career. This is just a way to make money. That's not a way to a happy and meaningful life, but to connect something that is really important to you, that gives your life meaning, that will make you wake up in the morning and get out of bed when Donald Trump pulls out of the Paris Accord. I didn't want to get out of bed that morning, but I did because this is my vocation. This is my calling. It's something bigger than me. It's not just me making money. If this was for money, I'd be gone.
The Paris Climate Agreement is a commitment by countries around the world to limit global warming. President Trump pulled out of it in 2019, but President Biden rejoined when he took office.
You put those two together, and I want to make sure that it's called out. For some people, it's a career. For some people, it's a calling or vocation, and they're very different. And I think one is much more internally focused, but also externally focused. A vocation is about serving. A career is about making money, about providing for your family, which is not a bad thing. But that is a key difference, I think. And that's something that I bring into my teaching in a very, very strong way. And it's how I think about my own path. I don't have a career as a professor. This is my calling. And I think that's not a simple statement. It you can unpack that. You asked, what is sustainable enterprise? And I have to give you an honest answer. I don't know. It's a title that was given to my chair. We talk about it in, you know, the IRB Institute for Global Sustainable Enterprise. From my mind, it's just a broad topic of what I focus on, and that is the idea of business being the solution to the sustainability problems we face. That's why I sit where I do, and that, I mean, look at it. The market is causing a lot of these problems. The market is causing climate change. But the idea that we're just going to shred capitalism and come up with a new system, that's just not plausible. Nowhere in human history do we have a chance to just wipe the slate clean and come up with a new system. Every set of institutions come from the institutions before. So we've got a market that's causing these problems. And if we want to solve them, we got to turn the market. The market is the most powerful orienting force on earth. Business is the most powerful entity within it. So if we want to solve these problems, we have to get business to solve them or they won't be solved. And to get business to do it, need to create business leaders that will focus on that. Mm. And that's my role as a business educator, is to try and create those kind of leaders that will see the problems and steer business towards solving them, which isn't a radical idea.
I think University of Michigan, in my view, has really exceeded all other universities in terms of that kind of applied learning and turning out students that can truly make a difference across the world of business, government, academia, nonprofits. And I'm so excited to talk to you about that. I mean, how you educate young minds and turn out these fantastic, sort of well-rounded, multidisciplinary leaders. I'd love to just hear how you approach that.
Well, there's how I approach it, but also I think something that is special at the University of Michigan that allows the institution to produce that as well. You know, every school has its own culture. And an aspect of the University of Michigan culture, to my mind, one of the best aspects of it, is that the boundaries between schools are very low. Some schools get very territorial. I won't use any names, but I know some schools, you step across another school's domain, you'll get your toes chopped off. I joke that the last school I taught at before Michigan, the only time I went over to engineering was to stay warm as I walked from one side of the building to the other. But at the University of Michigan, the boundaries get very blurry. I think of myself more as a University of Michigan professor than a Ross School of Business professor. I'll find myself in meetings with people from all over campus. But what this means for the students is the proliferation of dual degrees. A dual degree is an opportunity to fashion your own education. To say, I'm going to link psychology and climate science, or I'm going to link business and public policy, or business and law, or business and the environment. And at the University of Michigan, we have a very established program between the School of Business and the School of Environment and Sustainability. One of the biggest joys of this job is watching students grow and develop, see that passion, help build it. And maybe this gets to your original question, Tim, and maybe I'm circling around it, but I think a great deal of education is around imparting knowledge, and that's important, touching your head. But we also need to instill hope. We need to inspire. We need to touch the heart. And that's something that I don't think we're as good at, and we need to get better at, because if we're going to inspire the next generation of leaders, it's not just their head, it's their heart, it's their passion, it's excitement. That's key. And keep that connection going after they leave. That's key as well.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think I've mentioned before, but one of the things I think about a lot is like the echo chamber and the idea that, you know, you're surrounded by people you like listening to and you agree with. And so you don't often venture into the other side or the side that might be a bit difficult, or you might face a bit controversy speaking to, you know, like on some level for me, I think it'd be easier if I stuck with my environmentalist friends and, you know, we kept wearing Birkenstocks and ate organic produce. But like, also I think it's important that I'm out here fighting the good fight or in places in business and in places that might not seem at first glance as being the home for environmentalists, right? But when you look closer, you realize that there's such a need. And the more people that join and realize that, you know, we can fill these roles and help in this way, the more change is made.
Mm-hmm. I want to take that though, because if you can sit between two communities that don't really speak to each other, like oil and water, environment and business, you can see possibilities that either side can't. There's tremendous power in occupying that position. There's also dangers, though, too. You know, the old adage that the only thing down the middle of the road is the dead squirrel with a stripe over its back. Can you really be in the middle? There are tensions that come with that as well. You know, we have a joke at the Herb Institute that at the business school, I'm seen as a tree hugger. At the School for Environment, I'm seen as a capitalist sellout. You aren't really, you know, acknowledged as being part of either community. And there are tensions that come with that, which requires you need a strong support community on either side to help you maintain that complex identity. I'll often provoke my students saying, would you like to work at Patagonia or ExxonMobil on environmental issues? And think about it carefully, because Patagonia, yeah, definitely. You'll be surrounded by people who get it. Your impact will be small. You could be at ExxonMobil. You may be surrounded by people who don't get it. Your impact can be huge. But it's a challenge, you know, and you have to decide, where is your place? What is your temperament? Do you want to be a rock thrower working at Greenpeace, or do you want to be a handshaker working at the Environmental Defense Fund? You have to figure out how you want to play the game, what role you want to have, and go from there.
I want to pick up on this because I'm reminded of the phrase that the pioneer can be identified as the person with all the arrows in his back. And, you know, I felt that way throughout my career. As I mentioned, this field of being the tree hugger in the corporate world, which is the subtitle to my book, is new. And you can often feel like a stranger in a strange land, somebody who's trying to do things that just frankly, it's not natural. And I can remember when I jumped ship to leave the Senate and go to work in the private sector, everybody thought I was a sellout. So I've been down that path for sure. I'd love you to comment a little bit more how that feels and how your students, in particular the graduates that you've sent off into the working world, who, you know, used to have the choice, go to work, make money, and then maybe give back, but now are trying to combine their purpose and their profession. How does that feel? What are the lessons learned? What might you advise both professors and students, you know, how to bridge that gap?
We're at a very interesting time right now. I've never seen so much interest on sustainability within the corporate sector. I've never seen so many jobs with the word sustainability in them. So it's very interesting. Now, buyer beware. What was that survey by the Harris poll that came out about a month ago that 68% of CEOs think their company is responsible for greenwashing? So there's a lot of BS out there. But the idea that companies need to take stronger stands on living wages, fair wages, is being driven by market constituents. Employees are flexing their muscles in a very, very powerful way to say, you know what, Amazon, we want you to take a stronger position on climate change. Investors, and this is what you know, Tim, and it's been a very provocative topic of late, of ESG investing. Insurance companies, in a major way. You want to rebuild after those wildfires in California? Good luck. Let's see if you can find some insurance. And if you do, it's going to be very expensive. It's not going to have the same coverage. FEMA is pulling back on insurance on coastal properties. So the market is shifting. So it's a time where companies want to get ahead. And also, you know, if you want to attract the best and brightest, you have to have a position on these issues. So it's moving forward and the markets are shifting. I mean, what's the future of the auto sector? Folks, it's electric and then it's autonomous right behind it, period. End of sentence.
Mm-hmm.
Look at the oil or the energy industry and look at the oil majors and their market cap compared to some of the renewable companies. It's really astonishing what's changing and changing quickly. So I want to help students who come with an environmental focus or a sustainability focus and want to use business as a tool to push that. That's what I've always done. But I also want to give mainstream business students the opportunity to say, you know, you can work this in too. You know, the idea that the only purpose of a company is to seek profits and let government figure out the guardrails, it's very clean, it's very neat, it's not very realistic. When we teach students in business that the only purpose of a company is to make money for its shareholders, then we are taking agency away from our students.
You know, Andy, through this conversation, I'm sort of struck by potentially a changing paradigm. In our generation, the notion of a corporation working towards improving conditions for people on the planet was a man bites dog story. And even now, you know, you're split between two schools, the school of sustainability, school of business, right? And those two have to sort of interact. And you said sometimes you're viewed as a sellout in both areas. And so I'm thinking through what the future might be like. For example, in my own book, I think the main message that comes through is incrementalism and influence. Like you're sort of this little mouse among elephants, and you're trying to move this giant super tanker in tiny little degrees by influencing others. However, I think if I were to rewrite the book today, it would be that this entire area, as you said earlier, of ESG, of sustainability, has really been kicked upstairs. And now it's a fundamental core concept of any manager, any leader in a corporation, that if they don't have that concept, that they will quickly run into bad situations for their business. And so I think the world has fundamentally changed around us. That might change what a business school, a straightforward business school, actually instructs their students to do when they leave school and go into business. Do you see that future? Do you see it all integrating?
I see it as a potential future. I've been teaching sustainability in a business school since 1995. The way I've been teaching it is around the idea of the win-win. You can make money by protecting the environment. That leads to incremental solutions. That leads to sustainable hotels, a sustainable paintbrush, sustainable food. That's slowing the velocity at which we're running to a brick wall, but it's not reversing direction. And the problems we're facing today, climate change, for example. And climate change is not an environmental problem. Climate change is a systems breakdown. And you can't fix a systems breakdown with incremental solutions. You need systemic solutions. You need to transform. And there's where I think we need to go now. So as I said, I started in this field when no one was really doing it. And now everyone's catching up. And many business schools around the country, around the world, are bringing the sustainable development goals or sustainability more central to their curriculum.
The Sustainable Development Goals, or SDGs, were set by the UN to achieve a better future for people and the planet. We talked about them extensively in last week's episode with Jane Diplock, so go back and listen if you haven't yet. There are 17 of them, ranging from quality education and gender equality to clean energy.
And that's great. And I could sit back and rest on my laurels and say, hey, welcome to the party. Everyone's here. Or I can try and push forward across that frontier again and say, okay, where's the next hurdle? Because this will not solve the problem.
Andrew wrote a book titled How Culture Shapes the Climate Change Debate. He talked to us about how a polarized culture is one of the next climate hurdles we need to solve. We're not there yet, but Andrew's book is a head start.
In some, and for many, the conclusion of the book, and the book is gathering a lot of research done by others and some by me, but it's a sort of pulling it all together and put it in a digestible form so people can read it. But the major thrust of the book is that for many people, climate change is not about CO2. It's not about climate models. It's about worldviews that they hold, values that they hold, that they feel are threatened by the idea of climate change. The idea that we have a partisan shift, a split on climate change, speaks to that. There's the cultural dimension. Are Republicans and Democrats taught about science in any different way? No. Do they look at the issue through a particular lens? Yes. I was struck, I don't know if you've seen it, but Frontline had a three-part episode, Power of Big Oil. It was very good. And they had an interview with Bob Inglis, who I know and respect. A conservative congressman got voted out of office because he said climate change was real. And now he's made it his mission to get Republicans to recognize that climate change is real. But he said something, and it's in the documentary, and it really stunned me. He said, when he was a congressman, he didn't know much about climate change. All he knew was that Al Gore was for it, so he was against it. And I respect Bob, but that was a really awful thing to say. That's what it came down to, is just, if the left wants it, I don't want it. Or if the right wants it, I don't want it. And so once climate change entered the culture wars, it became a cultural issue. And so we need to start to think, the book offers four categories of the dimensions of that culture war. One is, who are the spokespeople? The messenger is important to the message. What is the message they're giving? How is it framed? What are the solutions they're proposing? It walks through all these things to really break it down into a deeper level. And not just simply, is climate change happening or not? No. What do we start to think about? Who cares about it? I want evangelicals to hear from evangelicals. I want people, we become tribal. You need to hear it from people in your tribe and then put it in the language of your tribe in order to get movement on the issue. And so that's what that book is about.
But I think it touches on an even more existential issue that you write about extensively. And I know, we won't solve it on this podcast, nor will we maybe solve it in all of our work collectively. But I just wanted to sort of touch on this because you opine on the post-truth society in a lot of your writings. And in one place you say, we are now immersed in an array of confusing and conflicting messages that question facts, blur the line between opinion and fact. And I think this is really at the heart of a lot of the issues that we've been discussing today and probably throughout our careers, that is getting worse, not better. I never thought in my lifetime that I would be living in a world where we had fundamental debates over things that are established fact, but that's where we are. And so what are some of your ideas about addressing that in your line of work, in our lines of work? I mean, how do we get back to a basis of fact that we can all then disagree about how to take those facts forward, but at least we agree on the facts?
Yeah. Well, what you read is drawn from a report done by the RAND Corporation called Truth Decay. And they had four conclusions. You list off two of them. One, we're debating facts. Two, we're blurring opinion facts, which I think is very important. I point that out to my students, and I even use it on myself. If you read a news story, pay close attention. Are they giving you the facts? Are they telling you how to think about those facts? Watch closely, because we're all susceptible to it. Number three, we're distrusting previously trusted sources of information. And number four, we've never seen anything like this, that social media is a big driver of this. So that sort of opened the Pandora's box. And our ability to source information that confirms our worldview, to push people out, that challenge our worldviews, this is what social media is doing to us. And lay that on top of the political divides, they're interconnected. And sadly, link in COVID. COVID has pushed us into isolation, where we are using social media to a larger extent, and we've become even more tribal. It's interesting. I spoke at a conference, and they had a speaker's dinner before the conference, and it was our first exchange in person with people we don't know. And I feel like people forgot that you're supposed to have polite conversation, and no, not everyone lived in your filter bubble. And so some things were said at the table that I thought, pre-COVID, you wouldn't have done this. You would have been a little more circumspect about bringing in some of your political viewpoints and approached it a little more gingerly. So we got to get back to that. But how do we think about people being more discerning consumers of information? Will our younger generation figure this out? I have hope and faith that we do. Now, the question for Caitlin is, what role do you want to have in making it the world you want it to be? There's where this starts to get interesting. There's where it starts to get exciting, because the future is not set. It's a fool's errand to try and predict the future, but we can make it. And there's the challenge for the next generation. And that's where it gets fun. And we have to think on systems. That's the key. And I think young people are more capable of thinking systemically than we are at our generation, Tim. And so the challenges are theirs. We need to provide them the tools to tackle them.
I love that summary. And Caitlin, I just want to maybe ask you for the last word or last question, because what we have done is sort of painted a picture where we may be going into a post-truth reality at a time when we all really need to come together. How does that look from your generation? What are you seeing in terms of bringing people together in terms of solving the world's biggest problems?
I think going off of Andy's point, on some level, I definitely find it important, and I think more and more young people do, that we need to kind of listen to views and viewpoints and have conversations that might be a bit uncomfortable. Because, you know, we can't go forward in a world like this that's filled with hatred. How are we supposed to, like, interact with the other people without being scared of what they might end up saying in conversation, or scared of them as people? We need to have more faith and love in others, and that's the way forward, right?
Yeah. My niece one time squared off with me in a friendly way. We're having a beer. And she said, you know, your generation caused these problems, and we reject your generation's dichotomous presentation of these problems, these black and white answers. The world is much more gray. And if you're not going to fix it, we're going to fix it. And that gave me hope. You know, Jonathan Haidt had a really nice essay in The Atlantic. He described social media, and he made a point in it that I really liked. He said that in social media land, if you draw a bell curve of the American population, it's the tails that are dominating the conversation, because they love to be vitriolic and they will attack you. On the right, they'll attack you on patriotism. On the left, they'll attack you on racism. But the vast majority are the exhausted middle. And A, they don't like this kind of engagement, so they'll pull out when getting attacked. So when will the exhausted middle start to speak up and say, enough, enough? This may work for you, but it doesn't work for the country and it doesn't work for the majority.
What I loved about what Caitlin said was two words, love and understanding. Oh my gosh.
And empathy. You
know, empathy. And empathy. You know, there are innumerable ways to encounter the world. And we're all going to encounter it differently. But if we live love, understanding, and empathy, then I think we can find that middle that you're talking about, Andy. It's such a great way to end this podcast because, you know, this has been one of the highlights of our short podcasting career, in my view. Such a wonderful conversation, learning from you. And my goodness, I think you might have just attracted a whole bunch of new students to the University of Michigan now. So I can't thank you enough for the conversation that we've had today. It's inspired me and I think inspired everyone listening to this. So thank you again.
Thank you both. I enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you so much.
Okay, wow. I was blown away by that conversation. I don't know about you, Caitlin, but maybe I'm too much of a fanboy. I love Andy's message. I think he's so well spoken, and the issues that we touched on, we could have gone on for hours. I mean, they're some of the most fundamental existential issues of our time. So that's how I felt about it. I'm still like kind of letting settle in and process. What did you think?
Yeah. I mean, I thought his views and how he sees like academia and business and the environment, they're so well-rounded. He's able to really see each topic from every different perspective. And that is so wonderful and refreshing, and it makes for a great conversation and super engaging. I mean, it's just nice to hear his path and how, you know, not every path is as straight as you think it is. And oftentimes there are loops and turns. And I like how he talked about serendipity and kind of the role that plays in vocation.
And this is a sustainability podcast, but then we get into things like living in a post-truth world, or how academics approach teaching young minds. And I just wish that message could get out there more broadly, that it really matters to look at the bigger world and what you're leaving as an imprint on the world. That first part of the conversation when he said, I've never had a job, I've had a calling, I've always worked for my calling. I just think those were some of the amazing nuggets that really resonated through the whole conversation for me.
Exactly. Thank you, Tim, and thank you, Andy, as well. It was wonderful.
That's it for this episode with Andrew Hoffman.
To learn more about Andrew and continue to be inspired, visit andrewhoffman.net. The link is in our show notes.
Announcement, SD podcast listeners. We're taking a super quick 2-week break, but we won't be gone for long, and we'll be back with a brand new episode on August 2nd.
So mark your calendars, everyone.
While we're on mid-season break, please check out the first 6 episodes of our show. We've had the most fascinating conversations since we launched the show, and we hope you'll recommend our podcast to friends and colleagues who might be interested in the topics we're covering. If you haven't already, you can check out our other show, Climate Tech with Kentaro, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Before we go, please don't forget to subscribe to Sustainability Decoded with Tim and Caitlin on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. While you're there, it would be great if you could rate and review the show. Thank you all for listening, and we'll catch you in our next episode.
Sustainability Decoded is produced by our incredible team at Persephone and Human Group Media. If you want to learn more about Persephone and our climate management and accounting platform, please visit our website, persephone.com.